Yesterday we were discussing the what appears to be a argument with regard to the Maschil Begnus and Messiah B'Shevach, that there's an obligation to begin with the degradation and conclude with praise. And there were two opinions. What exactly are we talking about? What's the degradation? One side says we were slaves unto Paro in Egypt. And the other side says that it's from the very beginning, our forefathers were idol worshippers. And that ends with the story of the fact that God brought us close to his service, meaning Sinai, and gave us the Torah and so forth. I just want to modify it a little bit, because I had raised some questions. For example, it seems that the mitzvah of the night is to recite the story of the Exodus. And how can you tell the story if not beginning with the enslavement? You don't need to tell me that. If you tell me that I have to tell the story of the Exodus, then you don't have to say it. In addition, you must begin with degradation and end with praise. It would seem to be unnecessary, superfluous. Because how else do you tell the story? Nobody would tell a story with the ending, start off with the ending, and then go back. I mean, we discussed that. We toyed around with that idea that sometimes you'll have a movie with a flashback. But in all things being equal, that's not the norm. That's not the way people tell stories. That's an exception. And I'm not going to bother now to try and analyze why people would do it with the flashback, whatever. That's an artistic thing. However, also, for example, the one who says that it's referring to the degradation of being idol worshippers. What does he do with the story of the Exodus and the enslavement? He does not include that. Of course you have to include that. That's the mitzvah of Sipur. So just to clarify things, we also found that both aspects are relevant to the story. That is, obviously, the story itself is about the enslavement and the achievement of the Exodus, the freedom. But it's also a story about idolatry, as we saw in the Rambam, that was something which happened to the Jews. That even though they had at one point been extricated from idolatry through Avraham and the succeeding generations, but when they became entrenched in Egypt and they began to expand and to grow, and also probably because of the oppression of the Egyptians, they lapsed back into idolatry. And he says that they had reached such a point of degradation that it was just virtually reached the point where the foundation, the fundamental of the true idea of God that Avraham had established was about to be obliterated. And then, of course, God intervened and sent Moshe. Now, what I would like to add to the discussion is that I don't think that this pertains, they're not arguing with regard to the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, which is to tell the story of the Exodus. That's a fundamental obligation, and everybody agrees that that's the case. And that's not when we're saying, in telling the story, you must begin with degradation and end with praise. That's not a qualification of the mitzvah of telling the story. And that's of course, if you're going to tell the story, you're going to tell the story that way. But that's not what they're talking about. Rather, there is a separate aspect of the mitzvah on that night.
Of Sipur, though?
Not a mitzvah of Sipur. Not a mitzvah of Sipur. Let's take a look at the Haggadah. There's another mitzvah on that. It's incorporated within Sipur. Sipur is multifaceted. There's many different aspects of Sipur on this night. Many different aspects of the Sipur. And they're arguing or disagreeing with regard to something which comes under the heading of Sipur. There's a pattern to the Haggadah. It's very important for a person to be cognizant of the pattern. There's different segments. They all come together, obviously, but one should have a sense of the structure. The first part of the Haggadah. All right, let's just go quickly through the different components. Obviously, everybody knows it starts off with Kiddush. The idea that you're supposed to be familiar with the structure, there is that the custom of reciting Kadesh or Rechatz, Karpas, and so on. That is, the headings, the bullets, the headings of the evening. And it's a custom of sort of reciting it. So you're looking at the general pattern, the structure. Of course, it begins with the Kiddush. Kiddush is that's the mitzvah to make Kiddush. Kiddush establishes the meal. You establish the meal and this is the beginning of the meal. Thus, all the mitzvahs of the evening are taking place within the framework of a meal. And the very substances of the meal, the foods we're eating, are connected to the telling of the story. Because that's something, it's not just abstract study, it's study in a very concrete kind of a fashion, and in a manner which makes an impact on a person's emotions. So it starts with Kiddush. Kiddush also partakes of fulfilling an aspect of the Sefer, telling the story, because you're noting the holiness of the day. That's incorporated into the Kiddush. There is a reference to the holiness of the day. It's the standard Kiddush, the standard Kiddush that we make for the holidays, has a general pattern, but then everyone has its own particular way you enunciate the specific. So here it starts off with that God chose us and elevated us and gave us seasons for joy. And then the specific, Chag HaMatzos Hazeh, the holiday of Matzos, Zaman Cheruseinu, the season of our freedom. So that's the essence, the Chag HaMatzos, that on this night we achieved our freedom. That's already incorporated in the Kiddush. And that's the first cup, the first kos of the four. Then it's followed by Karpas. Everybody knows the purpose of Karpas. Yeah, the purpose of Karpas, the idea of dipping, it's not just dipping a vegetable. And then you remove the Seder plate, is to stimulate curiosity by doing something which is unusual, to try and get people interested. That's an obligation of the evening, to do whatever you can do to facilitate curiosity, especially of children, but it's not whoever's going to be at your Seder. You want to get them interested. Thus, there's the objective shinui, change, which is the karpas, and removal of the plate. It's not just the fact that you're having a dip. That's not so unusual. But you're having a dip, and then you're removing the plate as though the meal is over. So that's just to garner their attention. Then you're supposed to try and figure out your own particular change, because that may not work for everybody. People have a tendency not to notice things. It was more pronounced then, because each person had their own plate. Their own table, rather. They used to have they didn't have a big table like we have today. Each person had their own couch to recline on and their own table, a small table, I guess like we would call a snack table. And then they would remove it, so then it's pronounced. But now we have a common table, and there's a lot of things on the table, so if you remove something from the table, it may not be that obvious. So you do your own personal change. Then, having done that, the next thing is you're getting into the mitzvah of Sefer, which begins with the halach ma'anya, and that is to explain the idea that there's a connection between the story and the object of the matzah. Then you have the so-called four questions, which, as we've learned, there's a difference of opinion whether these are the actual questions of the child, except in a formalized way. Or, as the Rambam says, that it's the responsibility of the leader to recite these four questions. They're not necessarily four questions, they're really four statements. That first, before you actually get into the telling of the story, you have to enunciate the ways in which the night is different. That's the Rambam's view. The difference being that, according to the Rambam, the reader the leader of the Seder has to recite the Manashtana. The way we do it, the other way, if you say that that's the question, so usually the youngest or the child asks the question. It's best, of course, to do it both ways. You lose nothing. You lose nothing by having the child do it, and then each person or the leader recites it on behalf of everybody. All right? Now, the very next part, after the four questions, the next series of paragraphs is really a study of the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's what's so fascinating. You don't just get into the Sipur itself, but now we study different aspects, different laws pertaining to it. And Avadim Hayinu, we were slaves. We were slaves unto Paro in Egypt. That paragraph deals with the mitzvah. What is the source of the obligation? The source of the obligation is the fact that we were slaves. Notice we don't say our fathers were slaves, as we pointed out. That we view ourselves as being part of a nation, and this nation, it's one nation which exists throughout history. It's all part of one nation, and what happened at that point in time happened to the nation, and therefore we explain that had God not redeemed us, we too would still be slaves. And thus we have the obligation to recite the story. And then it goes into particulars, who has the obligation? Even people that are very learned, and so on. That's Avadim Hayinu. We were slaves. Then you have the example, because we also learn through example, not just through pedagogy, through abstract instruction. The story of the rabbis that were gathered together, that's an illustration. In general terms, that's the illustration of the idea that even exceedingly great scholars not only are obligated to fulfill the mitzvah, but the extent. The other aspect of it, that there's an element of being involved, being immersed, to expand, not just to do it in a perfunctory way, but to expand the retelling of the story qualitatively by getting so involved in the in-depth discussion that these rabbis were up all night long. So that's an illustration. So we also learn from illustrations. That's an important point to remember. There's so much that you can gain from studying the Haggadah that this may seem like a small point, but it's not. That when you try to teach someone, it's also teaching you how to teach. So everything that it's saying has many different levels of significance and meaning. It's telling you how to teach. And a very important aspect in teaching is to know the balance between explaining things in the abstract and finding that suitable example that brings the point home. So here, too, you have the example. It would be incomplete if it just told us this in an abstract way. That would be one thing. But once you have a story of these rabbis and the extent to which they got involved, that they forgot to say the Kriya Shema, that has a different impact upon you. The next thing is the story of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. And that's something that should be studied more specifically, but we're just glancing over these things just to see the pattern. That's part of the... That's another illustration. It's an illustration, A, of something which is relevant to Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, which is the mitzvah of Kriya Shema. The mitzvah of we recite. That's important to know, that the ideas associated with the exodus from Egypt are fundamentals, connected to the fundamentals of Judaism. That's why Pesach is so significant. I explained last week the whole significance of matzah and the seriousness of chametz, what the ideas are, that these express, these reflect the fundamentals that Judaism is based upon. And the idea of remembering the Exodus is something which we're obligated to do twice a day. That's been incorporated into the mitzvah of Kriya Shema. So that's that story. That story then shows the connection between the story of the Exodus and the daily mitzvah to incorporate a remembrance. Now, a key issue is what is the difference between the mitzvah of remembrance of the Exodus, which we perform twice a day. That's at the end of the Kriya Shema. Ani Hashem Elokechem, I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt, to be for you unto a God. That's the basic remembrance, as opposed to this night. This night, it's not just a remembrance, but it's a full-fledged recitation of the story. Also, it illustrates the idea that he discovered a new idea that he wasn't aware of before. That is illustrating the point about Torah study and learning, in this case connected to the Exodus, that no matter how great a scholar you are, there's no such thing in Torah as, so to speak, mastering or knowing it all. It's only relative, and that a true scholar is always looking forward to learning new things. Or in another way of putting it is, as the Gemara says, Ein beis medrash b'li chiddush, that there's no study session without something new, if it's done correctly. Notice all these paragraphs we're doing at this point in time are all pertaining to different aspects of how to do the mitzvah. So we're actually preparing ourselves for the performance of the mitzvah at the Seder itself. The next thing we have is this is something which is famous. There are certain things in the Haggadah which are more famous. Everybody is familiar with the next section, which is commonly referred to as the four sons. And what does this have to do with the Haggadah, the four sons? So now we're studying educational psychology, basically. That's what it's about. Because a component of the mitzvah is what we call the Higadta Levincha. You shall teach it to your son, teach it to your children on that night. That a person is obligated in the course of the Sipur, if that person has children, to communicate these fundamentals to the child. And by extension, if you don't have a child, of course the child has to be on the level where they can at least understand it in a rudimentary fashion. The person doesn't have a child, so the next closest thing would be any person. A child would pretty much be any person that's not familiar with the story. So if you have friends or family or guests, and they really don't know that much about Judaism, so indirectly you're fulfilling this obligation. That being the case, there are then four prototypes, four different types of people whom you have to relate to in terms of education. Each, in very brief sentences, it's giving you an insight into the nature of the four different types of personalities who approach the information or the story, known as the wise son, the wicked son, the simple son, and the disengaged son, the one who Einu Yodea Lishol, the disengaged. We'll come back to that because I maintain that these are prototypes, not necessarily just of children. These are different types of people, even adults. It has nothing to do with the fact that a person is grown up. That doesn't change the person from functioning like a child. It's a functional phenomenon. Again, this section is a section dealing with the basic rules and regulations that pertain to how you're going to perform the mitzvah of Sipur. The final paragraph dealing with the subject is what we call Yochol Me'Rosh Chodesh. I would have thought from Rosh Chodesh. That is dealing with the issue of when is the obligation upon us. A discussion of the timing of the obligation. That is, I might have thought that we fulfilled the obligation of what? Of telling the story. So that's very, very interesting that for some reason or other, I would have thought that the obligation is not necessarily on Passover. That's what's amazing about that paragraph. And maybe you want to pursue it at the Seder. I want to leave you talking points for the Seder. That paragraph concludes with the idea that the time to perform the mitzvah of Sipur is when you have matzah and maror placed before you. Now, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, there's a deeper idea. And I was just doing it today. The question arises, what's the connection between the eating of the matzah and the maror? Is it just an accident that when do you do the story? When the matzah and maror is in front of you. When is the matzah and maror in front of you on that night? But other than that, there's no further connection. Now, basing himself on an analysis, the Rambam, in Laws of Chametz and Matzah, at the very beginning, before he goes into the laws, he lists the various mitzvos, commandments that pertain to the area. In this case, there are 8 commandments. Two are positive and five are... Three are positive and five are negative. Now, listen to the language, see if you notice a certain discrepancy which might be of significance. Any turn of phrase in the Rambam is important. Mitzvah number 7 is lecho matzah b'leile ha-pesach, to eat matzah on the night of Pesach. That's number 7. Number 8 is l'saper b'tzias Mitzrayim b'oso halayla, to talk, to engage in discussion of the Exodus from Egypt on that night. Did you notice anything in terms of formulation? The point is that in the mitzvah of matzah, he says to eat matzah on the night of Pesach. In the mitzvah of recitation of the story, he says to discuss the Exodus on that night. He doesn't say on the night of the Pesach. So Rabbi Soloveitchik's point was that the obligating factor of the mitzvah of Sipur is not the night. It doesn't reside in the night. That's not the obligating factor. Rather, the obligating factor is the obligation of chametz, of matzah. The obligation of matzah creates the obligation to tell the story. And it just so happens that matzah is on that. No, the obligating factor in matzah is that night, the night of the Pesach. However, it's not the night which creates the obligation of the sipur. Rather, it is the mitzvah of matzah. The mitzvah of matzah is the obligating factor in the mitzvah of sipur. That's his conclusion. Basing himself on that idea, he gives a further insight into the reason for the halach ma'anya, the connection between the matzah. That it's not just that the story has to be recited in conjunction with the object, but rather it's even more that. It's demonstrating the point that the very obligation to recite stems from the obligation of eating matzah. That ends segment 1. Just to spend a few more seconds on it, one can ask the question, why? Why is that the case, that the obligation stems from the matzah? Just briefly, or perhaps even superficially, you could go into it more in depth on your own. But as we've said, the matzah is very, very crucial. The matzah is what defines the holiday. It's Chag HaMatzah, says that. And the matzah itself reflects Geula. Now, if you remember, Geula means redemption. The only thing I would point out now, perhaps a little bit additional, is that when you say the Halach Ma'anya, well, in the Halach Ma'anya itself, it's giving you the explanation. The Halach Ma'anya gives the explanation. This is the bread of affliction that our fathers ate in the land of Egypt. So that's explaining the connection between the two. That's the idea of the, you're explaining the idea of the matzah. Now, there is a bit of a discrepancy in terms of defining the significance of the matzah. Because later on, before we actually eat the matzah, we're going to say the point of Rabbi Gamliel, that whoever did not say these three things, Pesach, Matzah, and Moror, whoever did not say means whoever didn't explain the significance of these three objects, the Pesach, that's the Passover sacrifice, the matzah, and the maror, did not fulfill his obligation. Did not fulfill his obligation. Now, that means that you have to understand the significance of the objects. Now, then it goes on to explain each one. The Pesach that we eat, for what reason? The matzah that we eat, for what reason? And it gives you the reason. The reason for the matzah is because of the speed of the redemption, that it happened so quickly that they did not have enough time for the bread to rise. And we mentioned that according to the Rambam, you have to say that God intervened and redeemed them immediately. That the immediacy itself is a sign, an indication of the miraculous phenomenon, that it's not a natural process, because all natural processes unfold within a certain time frame. As opposed to God's intervention, it breaks down the element of time. It happens so quickly. However, in the Holach Ma'anya, we're giving a different reason. The reason is not that the speed of the redemption, there the reason is, because it's the bread of affliction that our forefathers ate in the land of Egypt, implying that that's the food that slaves eat. Because slaves can't have, they don't have the luxuries. They just have the basic minimum. Or perhaps they don't even have enough time because they're slaves. They don't have enough freedom and leisure to bake fancy breads. And they're very poor, so they just have the minimum. That's what matzah does reflect, the minimal type of bread. In the reality of it, a person is eating matzah, you know, it's not on the same level. In terms of a bread, that's something, you know, real bread, leavened bread. It's like a cracker. It's even a question during the year, and we make the motzi on it, but the Sephardim do not even make a motzi on matzah during the year. Because for them, it doesn't have the status of bread. It's like a cracker. It's a mazonos. So what is it? Is the idea of the matzah the haste of the redemption, or is the idea of the matzah that it is the bread of poor, of affliction? Now, according to the Rambam, the proper way to do the Holach Ma'anya, this is the bread of affliction, you add three words at the beginning. Babehilu Yatzonu Mimitzrayim, with great haste did we leave Egypt. This is the bread of affliction. And thus both ideas are incorporated. Now I want to suggest that the matzah really reflects two things. As the Ramban explained it, the significance of the miracles of Pesach, the Exodus, the significance is because of an objective, there's an objective consideration that applies to everyone in the sense that it was revelation, as he explained. The teachings, the fundamental revelations that took place in the Exodus were to establish not just the existence of God, but the true idea of God in terms of God's relationship to mankind. That there's creation, that God designed the world for a purpose, and that God continuously relates to the world, and the phenomenon of miracles. That God has the power to change. God established the natural order according to his will, and he can change the natural order according to his will. It's a different concept of God. That's the matzah, which reflects the geula, redemption. But there's also, as the Ramban says, that verse in the first statement in the Aseret HaDibros, the Ten Commandments, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt from the house of bondage, which means that we have a special obligation. We have a special obligation in terms of how we relate to the phenomenon. That is, because we were in the house of bondage, and we experienced these miracles in a certain way, and the effect that it had upon us. So it's two things. One, any objective person should be able to understand the significance and recognize these truths about God. But that doesn't mean that he has the same obligations that we have to tell the praises of God, to recite the story, to do the commandments, the mitzvos. So that's the second aspect. That's the aspect of matzah. Matzah, one object, incorporates two ideas that are the foundations of the Exodus. That matzah reflects the idea of the miracles, meaning to say the geula, the redemption, the power of God in an objective way. But matzah also reflects our relationship to the phenomena, that we're God's people, that we experience the redemption. And because of that, we have to give praise. So that's why the matzah, that's why we're telling the story. We're telling the story. Now, the Rambam actually includes both ideas. Although the Ashkenazi custom is not to say, not that we don't say Babahilu in our Haggadah. The Rambam did incorporate it. So we just focus on the aspect of affliction, because that really is connected. That's the aspect of matzah that creates the obligation for us to do the sipur. But the Rambam incorporated both ideas. I see nothing wrong with, I do say Babahilu, because there's nothing against it, nothing wrong with saying it. It's just that the Ashkenazim apparently don't feel the need to say it. So that's the connection between the two. At this point in time, we've finished with our preparations. These are the preparations for the performance of the mitzvah. What do you do next? Now, what we've been doing, when I say we, I mean those of us in the yeshiva, is to pause and then do the mitzvah. What is the mitzvah? To tell the story. Now, if you go through the entire Haggadah, you will not see the recitation of the story in the Haggadah. That's an interesting thing. Nevertheless, if you study the Rambam, he says clearly that each person is supposed to tell the story, and of course to tell it to your children, to tell it in your own, there's a subjective element. That's very, very clear. There is a certain ambivalence in that it's very clear from the Rambam, it's very clear from the Haggadah itself when it talks about the four sons and how you're supposed to address each one, that there's a subjective element. And yet, if everybody says the same Haggadah, where's the subjective element? When are you fulfilling it? Thus, Rabbi Chait said a number of years ago that there is an element of telling the story which is not included in the Haggadah. There are certain aspects which are formalized, and the Haggadah has the formalized aspects. But the essential, the substance of actually telling a story in your own words and making it meaningful is not included. So at this point in time, one should pause, stop, and then tell the story. Have a discussion, at least in terms of the basics. For example, if there's a child at the table and the child is interested, 8, 9, 10, whatever it is, and hasn't fallen asleep yet. So at this point in time, you start talking and telling, and hopefully he'll ask some questions. And you cover the ground. I mean, how much or how little, that's up to you. That's where the subjective element comes in. That can't be scripted. So that's what we do at this point in time. We recite the story. At this point in time, we're going through another transition now. We're finished with the preparations for the mitzvah of telling the story. Then we actually can do the telling of the story. What is the next phase? Now we're shifting into another phase, which begins with the paragraph from early on, from time immemorial, our fathers were idol worshippers. Now that comes in, as we said, because of the dispute with the concept of beginning with degradation and ending in praise. But what do we've just concluded the basic mitzvah of telling the story. How does this fit in? It seems to be that once we begin with, at the outset, our forefathers were idol worshippers, and now God has brought us close to his service. So then it recounts the manner in which God related to our forefathers and guided them and protected them after they had made the essential discovery and had freed themselves from idolatry. So, along those lines, it mentions the promise, that God kept his promise. Because that idea, we're still focused on that idea, that God related to our forefathers and guided them with the purpose of forming them into a special nation that would exist eternally throughout history. So that leads us to the idea that God kept his promise. And it mentions the covenant between the parts, where God revealed to Avram the plan that his descendants would be slaves, the enslavement. And then that concludes with Vehisha Amda, that the promise, that the bris, that covenant, is what has always endured for us, so to speak. That because of that, that's the explanation for why, throughout history, in spite of all of the attempts to destroy us, it was because of that, that covenant that God made, and the fact that God keeps his promise, that we've been saved. Okay, that ends that segment. Then the next segment is another aspect, another dimension of the Sefer. We have different forms of Sefer. The first one is spontaneous, unscripted, your own words. This one is now through the study of Torah texts, to study the appropriate text in the Torah with the Midrashic interpretations. So now you're involved in Talmud Torah, studying Torah. Say Ulamad, go and learn. Now you have to, there's only so much that you can understand about something on your own, through your own investigation of history. Ultimately, you have to be able to study the Torah texts. That's a huge segment. That's a big segment, maybe the biggest segment. And that takes you all the way to the recitation of the 10 plagues. Then after that, you have further elucidation of the significance of the plagues, which is a very difficult discussion, which most people have problems trying to understand. It's the idea that each plague was really 5 plagues, and so on and so forth. That's a very important idea, though, even if you don't understand all the particulars. But the general point is to have an appreciation for the extent of the changes that were brought about, the changes in nature that were brought about with these plagues. One has to have a full appreciation. As we said, the miracles that took place are very significant as teaching tools about the existence of God and his relationship to the world. That segment being finished, the next segment is the famous statement of Rabbi Gamliel, that one does not fulfill his obligation if he doesn't understand the signification of the objects. That is, as we've said, most people take this to mean the obligation of Sefer, of recitation. Because the recitation is not just in the abstract, but it has to be in conjunction with certain objects, show and tell, so to speak, the mitzvos of the evening. So therefore, one's obligation of Sefer is incomplete unless one has elucidated the significance of the mitzvos. That is also important. To tell the story by way of explaining the meaning of the mitzvos of the night. There is a position, however, the Ramban, who holds that it's not the mitzvah of Sefer that he's lacking in, but he didn't fulfill the obligation of the actual mitzvah itself. That is, if he ate the matzah without explaining what the matzah is, he did not fulfill the mitzvah properly. That is, he did fulfill it. It's not that he didn't fulfill it at all. But Rabbi Gamliel is saying, according to the Ramban, what Rabbi Gamliel is saying is that the performance of the mitzvos on this night are not like other mitzvos. You wouldn't have such a requirement, for example, on sukkos, when you go into the sukkah. And obviously there is a reason for the sukkah. The sukkah, the pasuk says, because I housed the Jews in sukkos when I took them out of Egypt. That is, during the trek in the wilderness, the Jews dwelled in sukkos. Now there's an argument there too, as to whether it's actual huts. It's a reference to actual huts that they lived in, or whether it's a reflection, it's a reference to the, so to speak, clouds of glory that surrounded them, meaning that there was a special hashgacha, a special protection, as we read. Which the fact is that the clothing of the Jews did not shrivel and rot as it normally would, and your feet and so on and so forth. That God protected you in a personal kind of way in the wilderness. Whatever the case may be, there's no requirement that a person has to enunciate that. No one says whoever did not enunciate these ideas did not fulfill his obligation of sukkahs. That is, as long as a person knows that this is a sukkah, he goes in there because he wants to do the mitzvah, even if he has no thoughts, he's not thinking, no cognizance of the purpose of it, he still fulfills the mitzvah. Yet according to the Ramban, that would not be the case. The Ramban is saying that that's the reason why we say Pesach, Matzah, and Maror is in order to fulfill the actual mitzvah of matzah properly. What's the difference? With regard to the mitzvahs in general, there are two distinct areas. There's the technical performance of the mitzvah, which is a halachic requirement. And then, of course, there's the reason for the mitzvah. Every mitzvah has a reason. We may not be aware, there are certain mitzvahs where it's difficult to discover the reason. By and large, though, most of the mitzvahs, we're aware of the reason, in many cases, the Torah itself, especially those that are associated with great events in the past. So the Torah makes clear what the reason of the sukkah is. But there are two distinct areas. And the requirements, interestingly enough, the requirements for fulfilling my halachic responsibilities in doing the mitzvah do not necessarily include involvement of the purpose. That is, it's two different areas. This is the technical mitzvah. This is what you have to do. This is what your performance involves. Now, you want to know the philosophy? That's a different area. Of course, the more you delve into the philosophy, the more you'll get out of the mitzvah. There's no question about that. However, they are regarded as two separate areas. I fulfilled my obligation. If everybody fulfills their obligation, as a result of that, the mitzvah of sukkah will be performed, and the idea, meaning the reasons of sukkah, will be perpetuated. But it's two distinct areas. Now, I think what the Ramban is saying is that with regard to the mitzvahs on Pesach, the reason for the mitzvah, the idea of the mitzvah, is part and parcel of the very performance of the mitzvah. And this will help us to understand the intimate connection between, for example, the mitzvah of matzah and the mitzvah of sipur. The mitzvah of matzah is not just a technical activity of eating the object. It too. Everything we do on Pesach has to contain elucidation and understanding. That's what the Ramban says. That the ideas associated with the matzah have been incorporated into the matzah. Thus, if a person just ate matzah, even though the person had the intention of doing the mitzvah, well, as we said, if a person did not recite this paragraph, didn't know what the matzah means, he still would fulfill the mitzvah. No one's saying he would not fulfill the mitzvah. According to the Ramban, Rabbi Gamliel, is saying he didn't fulfill it properly, though. He didn't fulfill it on the highest level. Because part of the mitzvah is to be cognizant of the idea of the redemption, that the matzah is an object which expresses the redemption. That's the Ramban's idea. The next phase begins with, in every generation, b'chol dor v'dor, in every generation. This is significant because pretty much we've told the story. We've raised questions, we've studied about all the aspects of the mitzvah of the story, we've told the story, and then we studied. We told the story by study, and then we explained, we elucidated the meaning of the objects. We've told the story in many, many different ways. What is this phase of in every generation? This is another aspect of the mitzvah, of the night, and that is, it's a very challenging mitzvah, by the way, that a person is obligated to see himself as though he himself left Egypt. The Rambam has a slightly different expression, laharos es atzmo, to demonstrate, to show, present himself. Here it's just to view himself, as though he left Egypt. And the pasuk, of course, for everything that we say, we have to cite the text. The text cited is that you shall tell it to your child on that day, saying, because of this did God do to me. So the way the Torah expresses it, that you have to tell your child that God did this to me, which means that it's your personal story. You have to reach that point where you actually view it as though you yourself have left. That's the impact. That is to say that the recitation of the story is supposed to generate a certain emotion within you. What's that emotion? How would you feel if you left? So you have to be filled with a certain sense of awe, gratitude, all of the different feelings that a person who actually was there and left would feel. You have to now be able to see yourself in that light. And that's what it says. Not only our fathers were redeemed, but God redeemed us as well. So you have to be able to partake of the redemption. And as I said, that could be the most challenging thing. I wonder how many people actually fulfill this. But this is associated with the next paragraph. It becomes very, very important. What's the practical consequences of this? The practical consequences are spelled out for you in the next paragraph. Lefichach, therefore, we are obligated to give praise, all different expressions of praise, to extol, to praise, to be thankful. That's the whole idea. So therefore, everything is leading towards a certain goal. And that goal is to renew a certain type of relationship with the Creator, one of positive appreciation. The appreciation part, that's for the fact that God redeemed us. And that's what it says, to bless, to extol, to praise, every possible expression. For he, l'misha salavosenu, for the one who did to our fathers, vilano, and to us. So we're no different now. It's as though it happened to us. All of these miracles. And then you list them. This, of course, is the transition to the final phase of this aspect of the Seder, part one. And that's going to be Hallel. That's why we actually say Hallel. Hallel is songs of praise for miracles. This is the transition. Because without this, how can we say Hallel? You don't say Hallel for something which didn't happen to you. This is the transition. And now we can say Hallel. And then, of course, the next part is the blessing. The blessing for the redemption. Praising God who redeemed us and redeemed our fathers from Egypt. It's interesting. Notice a contrast. Take a look at the paragraph, therefore, Lefichach. Therefore, we are obligated to give praise, extol, and so on and so forth. L'misha salavo seinu vilanu. For the one who did for our fathers and us. Our fathers first, then us. However, in the blessing, now, go forward a little bit. After the Hallel, the blessing of the redemption, we blessed art thou, Lord our God, King of the universe, Asher Ga'alanu, who redeemed us and redeemed our fathers from Egypt. Now we're mentioning ourselves first. Why is it that at first we mention in the Lefichach, therefore we're obligated to give praise to the one who redeemed our fathers and us? Our fathers I mentioned first, and that was what seems to be significant. Because the redemption took place to our fathers, primarily, we're secondarily. However, in the blessing, we recite, he redeemed us, and we mention our fathers secondarily. I would say as follows, to explain it. The paragraph of Lefichach, therefore, is delineating the obligation. So we're not quite there yet. It's just telling us what the obligation is. In expressing the obligation, it's a new idea. The basic, the primary idea is that God redeemed our fathers. That comes first. That's how you'd express it. In a primary way, the redemption occurred to our fathers, and not to us in a primary way. we come into the picture secondarily. That is, if we understand all of the consequences, and then we could see how our freedom comes into the picture, then we could, secondarily, we can see that this is in the abstract, it's an event that pertains to us as well. But that's secondarily. Primarily, that's like anything else. I mean, many times you'll have a situation like this, that somebody may have given a gift to your parents, but the intention was that it should not just be restricted to the parents, but it should be passed on to you. So, okay, you have to appreciate it too, because you were intended, you were included. But in a primary way, it pertains to your parents, in a secondary way to you. That makes sense. Now, I believe, however, that that's introducing us to the concept. Then we're supposed to get involved in the concept, and we're supposed to praise God by saying Hallel. In terms of the actual praise and the thankfulness, then it's Asher Allah Nu. When I'm praising God, I'm praising, first and foremost, it's for me. When I'm uttering a praise, the praise, I become primary. Because in terms of praising, I'm praising you for something you did to me. Then I wouldn't mention somebody else. That would be taken away from the praise. You understand? There's two things over here. In terms of the way it unfolds, the primary recipient, let's say, is your parent. Getting back to that person who gave the gift. The primary one. But you should be able to see and feel gratitude because you were included. Okay? So now, if I were to encounter that person, there was a time was set aside for me to give thanks. So in terms of my expression of thankfulness, I'm going to focus on me. Because that's what makes me thankful. The more I would mention that primarily, I'm only secondary, that would be taken away from the gratitude. You see? So when it comes to expressing the gratitude, you're the focus. I'm expressing gratitude for what you did for me. And, of course, then you mention, and for my parents as well. That's secondary. It's reversed. Thus we see that there is a specific obligation of praise on the night. And all of the activities, all of the recitations, the story, the telling of the story is supposed to lead to a certain goal. And that goal is a recognition of the Creator and His relationship to us. And a very, very big word would be appreciation. A real profound sense of appreciation for what God has done for us. And that, I think, is the idea of Maschil Bignus and Messiah Mesheva. That it's not telling us how the story ought to be told. The story, of course, is the story of the Exodus, that we were slaves. Everybody would know that, that you start at that point. It doesn't make sense to start at the end and go back. That's not what he's telling us. In Maschil Bignus means that in terms of the obligation of praise, that there cannot be any praise unless one has a recognition and awareness of the significance of the degradation. Praise is always related to the degradation, to the negative. Whatever you did, if I have to praise you for a favor, so I can't just thank you for the favor until I elucidate the situation I was in, how significant it is. You always try to do that. If somebody did something really important for you, not an ordinary thing, but something really important for you, then, and you really feel thankful and appreciative, you spell out, you have no idea what would have happened to me. If you don't do that, then you're lacking in the praise. The praise must include the situation that you were in, and you saved my life, that kind of thing, or whatever it is. So here too, since there's an obligation of praise, the first thing is maschil, and it's not just the first thing, it also means the significant thing, that you really have to focus. If you don't focus on the degradation, now I'm not saying it's just to mention it, but to focus on it, to consider it, so then it's lacking in the praise. And that's what the issue is about. Insofar as the subject matter of the praise is concerned, is the essence of the praise, the redemption from Egypt. Of course, it has significance only because of the philosophical ideas. Of course, it's connected to the whole story that our forefathers were idol worshippers and that there's a purpose. Of course, but the focus of the appreciation and the gratitude and the praise is the Exodus. That's the primary object. The rest is philosophical. Or, that's one opinion, and that would be Avodah Mayim L'Parav Mitzrayim. To focus on that degradation of being a slave nation, and all of its consequences, and now the idea that we obtained our freedom. Of course, if you ask me what's the significance of that freedom, there's no question that it has to do with the fact there, the philosophical ideas, the metaphysical ideas, and so forth, but the praise relates to the Exodus. The other opinion holds that it's not denying that, but it's maintaining that the essential object, the essential theme for which we have to give praise is that God, that is to say that the Exodus is very, very important, but it's not it's only the means to the real praise. The real praise is we were idol worshippers and God brought us close to his service. It's true that it expressed itself through these events. You got to tell the story. No one's arguing what the story is. But the key aspect that a person has to focus on in terms of the praise is the fact that God brought us close to his service. That's the whole focus. The rest is a means. And therefore, if that is the focus, then the maschil bignus, that is that part where you consider the degradation. The degradation over here would be that of the Avodah Zarah HaYavaseinu. That this was, we have to study history. We have to know that from whence we came, and we were not from a special group that was not tainted by the idolatry which overcame the world. If we trace ourselves far enough, we will find that we go back to Terach too. And because there were great individuals. It is true that there were great individuals, but you'll understand the sequence now of that section. It's true that there was an Abraham. It's true that there was an Isaac. And one could say, okay, so that's why we have the true ideas. That's not the reason. That was not the reason. It's not because of these people. These people on their own discovered it for themselves, and maybe they would have taught it to their children a couple of generations, but it wouldn't have affected us. It's only because of the intervention of God. And that God, that's God took them and God used them as the vehicles to fulfill his objectives for mankind. But if it wasn't for the providential relationship of God, that's the whole idea that v'hishe amda, that God establishes a covenant and God keeps the covenant and God continues to relate to us in spite of all our sins. That's the idea. It's God. The aspect of the fathers and so forth is important, but that's not the reason. That is not the reason. That's part of the story. The reason is God and God's providence. And the person, to really fulfill the obligation of praise, has to appreciate the degradation of idolatry, what the alternative would have been. And to appreciate the great good, the great benefit of being brought close to the divine service, to the true idea, the true religion, so to speak. As much as I don't like that word. This is the big challenge for the Jews today. Because I don't think they're capable of this. I do not think that most Jews have any clue of what this really means, in my opinion. Because, and this has to do with the theme that I've been discussing the last couple of months in light of that whole discussion about pluralism and everything. And my sense of it is that Jews are very, very uncomfortable with these ideas of comparing one religion to the other. They cannot even see the difference. They cannot see the difference and can't appreciate the essence of Judaism, true ideas of God, and how man ought to relate to God, and the falsities of the other religions. They measure religions purely in terms of superficial aspects of conduct. So that, yeah, they don't like Islam today because Islam is involved in terrorism. And Christianity is not so bad because it's not involved anymore in persecuting people. But in terms of recognition of the evil of idolatry, and appreciation of Judaism, very few people, in my opinion, have a real appreciation of Judaism. It's our religion. They're happy. They like to be Jewish. They like to be part of the Jewish people because of pride, because of history, because of culture. But the Haggadah challenges us to reach a new level, a new dimension of a true appreciation of Judaism, which is only because of the fact that it's true and that without it, we too would be idol worshippers. That, I think, my sense of things is that very few people can really appreciate that. The whole idea, the whole attitude that would enable you to reach this is discouraged. That's like the people who make that claim that we have the true religion and the other religions are false. That is, as we say in Aleinu, Shehei Mishtachim Lohev Varek, that they bow down to vanity and emptiness. Umispal Lemele Lo Yoshia, and they pray to a deity that can't help them because it doesn't exist. Vanachnu Karim Mishtachim, but we bow down and we pray Lemelech Malchei Melachim, to the King of Kings, the Kadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He. That's the essence of our appreciation of Judaism. That whole idea, that whole notion, even though Jews say Aleinu, but they don't really appreciate the ideas that it contains. The real challenge of the evening, after all is said and done, is to be able to appreciate Judaism. To appreciate Judaism and to say hallel because of Judaism. That's what he's saying. Not just because we were a slave, on any level. Even if you say it's the degradation is slaves and the praise is freedom. But that the whole benefit of that is only because of the fact that we can serve God properly. But according to the other side, the whole focus has to be on the kervano part, that God brought us close to His service. So in effect, according to this view, the essential gnus, the essential praise, is to praise God for Judaism and to be filled with appreciation and gratitude for Judaism and really feel it. But I think that it's very, very few people that are even aware that that's what they're supposed to be doing. And if you were to tell them that, I think they'd have a tough time. When they think about Judaism today, or Jews, people who take it seriously, will think about the pride that the Jews have a disproportionate amount of people that are in significant places and in the arts and in business and so forth. The state of Israel, the achievements of Jews. That's what makes them proud. But the appreciation of Judaism is something, it's such a hidden thing. Judaism is so hidden and unknown, even from those who practice it, let alone to be able to appreciate it. Which is why Mashiach has not come. I think those are connected one way or another. That perhaps when Judaism is recognized and seen and appreciated and lived, I'm not into using the messianic idea as, you know, to motivate people, but I think that has a lot to do with it. That's part of what it's about. The world will appreciate it as well. But first the Jews have to appreciate it. And that's what the idea of the Seder is all about. It's interesting because the second half, after the meal, the last two cups were saying Hallel. That Hallel is directed towards the Yemos HaMashiach. And that theme is there too. That now we are slaves. Next year we'll be free. Now we are here, next year in Jerusalem. It's really a recognition that we're in exile. That's the Halach Ma'anya, is the foundation of a Seder which is to be held in the exile. That's the whole starting point. The standpoint is from the standpoint of exile. And as long as you're in exile, you really cannot fulfill it properly. So we do the actions and we say the words, but the ideal of a true appreciation and true thanksgiving for Judaism is not attained at this point in time, except by a few.